then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's Christmas Eve, December the 24th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Since next week will be our end-of-the-year show with nothing but music, this will be our last speaking episode, so to speak, for the year 2015, and what a long, strange trip it's been. So I'll use this last full episode of the year to see if I can clear up a few odds and ends that I've got lying around. To begin with, I've got a few emails that I'd like to take care of. Dear Comrade Harold, it's Jason in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm picking vacation at work for 2016, and I'll be making my scouting trip in the fall sometime. I know you've suggested certain times of the year in your podcast, but I can't remember specifically. So what weeks and months during the fall do you recommend for Western Washington? Thank you, Jason. Okay, to recap, I am never in favor of anyone taking their scouting trip to the Northwest homeland in the dead of winter, although an amazing number of you do. Usually because the dead of winter is the only time that you can get vacation from your jobs elsewhere in the country, or else because that's when your job interviews here in the homeland occur. The weather in the Pugetopolis especially is not conducive to displaying the homeland at its best during the winter. There's a saying out here that every Northwest summer is different, and every Northwest winter is the same. This year, we had an absolutely magnificent summer, nicer than I've ever seen before since I've been here, I think. And this fall, which is when the season of heavy rain begins, it's been absolutely wretched. Now, if you're scouting this area, I recommend that you come here between early May and early October, with possible emphasis on mid-June for the long 16-hour days with daylight savings time, or else mid to late September, bearing in mind that out here, September is pretty much a summer month. Very early October can be splendid as well. I'll match in quality the fall color of this part of the world to anything in New England or down the Appalachian Trail, but there's just less of it. Now, if you're scouting the inland homeland, say eastern Oregon, around Bend or Corvallis or Spokane or Idaho, I recommend the summer months. Bear in mind that some parts of the homeland, such as Spokane, northern Idaho, western Montana, so forth and so on, can be downright blizzard-like in the middle of the winter, both for scouting and for living. I know people who live in northern Idaho and swear by it, but if you move there, just bear in mind you need to enjoy winter sports and be able to afford some pretty big heating bills. West of the Cascades, on down to I-5, the weather's not quite so brutal in the winter, although you still don't want to be stuck out in it like that one poor homeless bastard we had come here earlier this year who somehow got the idea that we were going to take him in and put him up indefinitely in somebody's guest room. Now, that's not going to happen, by the way. We are clear on that, right? Almost every month, I'll get an email from some sad sack promising to hop on the next bus out here and asking for directions to the bunkhouse, wanting to know what life is like in the bunkhouse and if beer is allowed, so forth and so on. Now, that Aryan Nations compound at Hayden Lake cast a long shadow and left us a legacy. Not all of it good. So, Jason, in your case, I'd probably recommend August or September for your scouting trip. Now, this next email is from Ron in Richmond, Virginia. Dear Harold, you're complaining about a drop in listenership for Radio Free Northwest. Did you not get a big bump back in June
when that kid Dylan Roof did his thing?
I remember you making some comment about that at the time. Didn't the publicity attendant on gunning down a bunch of niggers bring the Northwest Front to the attention of the white public? Signed, your old comrade Ron. Okay, it's a little more complicated than that, Ron. Yes, we got a bump when Dylann Roof threw his little hissy fit on the night of the Charleston Vespers. But it was a quantity bump, not a quality increase in viewership of the site and listenership to the program, and it was only temporary. Now, the first thing you need to understand is that the mainstream news media is now completely polarized on the red-blue system, and yes, I know that dichotomy is confusing to our British listeners. It's the exact opposite in the UK, in that red is left-wing Labour and blue is conservative Tory. Here it's the reverse. Blue states are Democrat and red Republican. Anyway, the media, like the population, are now completely polarized, and events like the Dylann Roof episode receive disproportionate coverage from the blue or left-wing media who want to scream for gun confiscation before the little old nigger church ladies find Dylann Roof under their bed. We got almost no coverage from the red or conservative media who downplay such incidents for the same ideological reasons. When the Dylann Roof thing hit, the publicity the party received was almost all from outfits like The Guardian, Politico.com, The Stranger here in Seattle, and other raving left-wing loon sites. Yeah, we got increased hits on NorthwestFront.org, but not really from a lot of people that we would ever want to join us. The average Guardian or Stranger reader is some kind of morally diseased, aging hippie or butt-fucking commie freak, and is not Northwest Front material to begin with, so a lot of those Dylann Roof hits were useless. Empty calories, so to speak. Let me try and explain how these things work in real life, or how they appear to work from where I sit. Bear in mind, I don't claim to fully understand this arcane process. This, by the way, is one reason I don't want any of you people out there who are suicidally inclined to go nutso with a gun, thinking you'll finally bring the Northwest Front to the attention of the white public. It doesn't work like that, and the Dylann Roof incident proves it doesn't work like that in the real world. First off, the overall character of probably the majority of white Americans has become so decayed and attenuated that when we attempt to engage in what the Reds call propaganda of the deed, we get the Joe Stack reaction to somebody's sacrifice of their own life, which is kind of a, yeah, what do you know? That guy killed himself to prove a point. Well, wow, that's interesting. Now, who's on Dancing with the Stars tonight? Americans have essentially had any real interest in politics bred out of them by generations of social engineering and cynical manipulation. Americans understand that our national politics and our power structure are diseases which are killing us, poisoning us like cancer, but that's how we view the political system, as something like cancer. Overwhelming, baffling, invincible and inexorable and inevitable. A force of nature like an earthquake or a flood. Nothing to be done about politics or the power structure. Just stay out of its way and try not to be caught in the writhing tentacles and crushed as Hillary Clinton rises from milieu like Cthulhu and assumes mastery of the world. So the long and the short of it is that while we can occasionally attract some interest to NorthwestFront.org through some kind of system publicity or event like Dylann Roof or the Bionic Backpack incident in Spokane or a couple of times we've been linked on Drudge, it is, in a large part, not a lasting kind of interest. It's more of a quick click of a mouse and a, huh, look at that, white country in the Northwest, like, wow, man, cool. Now let me click on the mouse again, see if I can find some porno, dude. It's that kind of interest. Yeah, these incidents, or the bizarre and sometimes bloody publicity, do generate a spike in hits. Now, if memory serves, during the Dylann Roof bump, we got a record of something like 21,000 hits during one 24-hour period of that entire 4 and 5 days, but after a week, the number of hits had receded once again to what it was the week before. People had satisfied their idle curiosity, and they moved on to the latest sensation, which was Bruce Jenner getting his Johnson bar cut off, or whatever it was back in June. Now, I'm not saying that we didn't pick up any permanent new readers and listeners off the Dylann Roof incident. We did. And I know that because I've heard from them, although certainly not enough to justify a young white man sacrificing his life. And I know that we picked up some steady new listeners through the All Nationalist Network also, although those listeners don't show up on our stat counter because I've heard from some of them as well. But so far, we're talking about listeners, not doers, or at least mostly so. Now, next month, I will be beginning the 7th year of Radio Free Northwest. God, time flies when you're having fun. Now, when I first got started in the podcast field, there was TalkShoe and a few others, but we were definitely among the first. I think we in our wee little movement always thought that if somehow we could just leap over the last barrier of censorship and blackout, and actually break into uncensored and openly racial audio and then video, where, like Hitler, we could use the spoken word with humor and passion, then that would do it. The magic beans would finally tumble to earth and take root in the soil and blossom into actual physical action on the part of white people. Not just lying there like so many sponges, absorbing, absorbing, and absorbing all these words and doing nothing. And we're doing that now, the spoken word, in some cases doing it quite well, in fact. And like our blogs and our newsletters and our bad news porn emails, we're doing it for tiny, tiny audiences, while the remainder of our race have no idea that this audio and video exists and no way to access it or listen to it or watch it. You see, when something new comes out that's really good, we only tell each other about it. Not the muggles, not the people at large, because we are so terrified of being identified and exposed as racists and being cyber-shamed on Twitter and losing our precious jobs. We are so paralyzed with fear of having bad men come and take our stuff that we only talk to each other lest someone in the real world find out that secretly we think bad thoughts. Even for something as amusing as more Q YouTube videos, the exposure seems limited to everybody's own little circle jerk of email or internet contacts. It reaches a top level of X thousand hits or views, depending on which of the email circle jerks the link is distributed on, and then it stops and goes no further. There is always some exposure to new white people, of course, but it's more by accident than anything else. No one is willing to go out onto the internet and research and find out where the young white people hang out, and then barrage them with links by Torrent and Twitter and Reddit and 4chan or whatever else is necessary until hundreds and thousands of young white people actually get curious and go to that More Q video, or to northwestfront.org. Now it's 7 years on, and everybody and his dog has a racial podcast, and the Magic Beans have yet to put in an appearance. We still have audiences, not members. Audiences who basically do nothing except sit there demanding next week's free ration of entertainment so that they can giggle at us saying the word nigger and so we can validate their belief that it's all hopeless and they must say or do nothing that might actually make the people with power mad. Right now, if I had to guess, I'd say that there's at least 50,000 internet listeners to us, the Daily Stormer, Stormfront Podcasts, all the other podcasts, and the More Q videos, etc. 50,000 people is more than enough to create and fund a movement. But it's not happening. And okay, we'll get into why a little later in this podcast. But one reason it's not happening is our congenital inability as a movement, our inability as a people to get it together, to act in concert in an organized and disciplined way and not be intensely interested for 15 minutes and then wander off. Our pathological inability to persuade others to act, to get our relatively small audience to be anything other than an audience. It's that defective white character again.
Hello, comrades. My name is John, and I'm 21 years old. Currently, I live in Pennsylvania, though I'm working as hard as I can to get out to the homeland sometime relatively soon. When I read Hill of the Ravens and saw the part where Mr. Covington refers to Frank Palmieri as a born National Socialist, I just couldn't think of a better way to describe myself. I remember as a kid seeing documentaries and such in history classes in school where they showed clips of the SS and SA marching to Defana Hulk and such and saying, aren't these men so evil? And to me, I said, well, no, that looks really cool. I don't know what it was, but there was always something there that attracted me to them and what they did. I knew that they were right from some gut feeling in my stomach, and quite honestly, I just couldn't explain it, but I have identified as a National Socialist or Fascist, depending on my mood as a kid, for as long as I can remember. I was introduced to Odinism or Asatru, whatever you want to call it, through black and death metal bands, mostly from Scandinavia and Eastern Europe. That was really important for me, and I found a pretty spiritual side of myself through that. However, my introduction to the actual movement as is was kind of different. My high school offered a pretty great German language program, though it was very politically kosherized. The linguistic end was taught phenomenally, and we often had opportunities in the summer to go and visit European countries on pretty damn cheap budgets. So I took advantage of that one summer, and I absolutely fell in love with everything I saw there. The one thing that caught me most and stayed with me most, I believe, was the nationalist undercurrent I observed in Europe, mostly in Germany and Austria, though Budapest had quite a seemingly strong nationalist undercurrent as well. After all that, I came home and I started researching these different groups of people, like the NPD and the FPO and whoever else, the Jobbik Party in Hungary, if I'm pronouncing that wrong, I apologize, but I noticed that these people, yeah, they have some really great things to say and that their message is right, but they just don't do anything. They honestly believe that someday they'll be voted into power through some kind of majority and then everything will be fine again. It's just beyond me that they could see nothing more than that in their own doctrine, that they feel that there's nothing more that they could do. It's kind of astonishing, honestly. In Europe, there has always been a tradition of a political soldier, and today the political soldier has become a political activist, and the two are just completely different animals. I know I'm going to insult a lot of our European listeners when I say this, but guys, Europe is a lost cause, as is. I've seen it. I've been there. I know NPD people. I know BNP people. And these countries are just failing miserably. There is overwhelming immigration, overwhelming immigrant birth rates, and pretty much no white replacement birth rate. It's just a matter of time. The only way anything is going to get better is if those men become twice the political soldiers that their forefathers were, and I just don't see that happening. Sorry, but it's the truth. Here in North America, however, we have land. We have a plan. We have enough of us, and enough of a mindset to get this done. We have a place in the Pacific Northwest that we can call home, that we could do what we need to do, finally, and secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. If only we would get off our asses and do it. Our comrades in Europe, though, are outnumbered all the time by commies and such and are facing, you know, hate crime charges and hate speech charges and thought crime charges all the time for what they believe. And even though they don't accomplish anything, they still do it because they know it's right. We know it's right, and we have a whole lot better options here, and we don't take advantage of it. Why is that, guys? What else do we need to know? Our race is facing literal extinction in every way possible across the world, and we have the best option possible, and we are not taking advantage of it. There's nothing that bothers me more as a person. I have always been inspired by military and political march kind of songs, and I'll read this now, and I think that it will maybe hit home with a few of you. The British Union of Fascists, led by Oswald Mosley, had their own version of the Horst Wessel Lied, which was called Comrades the Voices. Ian Stewart from Screwdriver adopted that and made it into Hail the New Dawn, I believe it was called. The following lines really say a lot to me and say a lot about what we need to do and who we are, and I hope it does to you too. We're of their blood and spirit of their spirit, sprang from that soil for whose dear sake they bled. Gainst vested powers, red front, and massed reaction, we lead the fight for freedom and for bread. We lead the fight, comrades.
Now, of course, would be an excellent time to play that Ian Stewart song, but since it's Christmas Eve, instead we'll kind of go from the sublime to the ridiculous. This is the Royal Guardsman.
Out in the First World War, the bloody Red Baron was flying once more. The Allied command ignored all of its men and called on Snoopy to do it again. Was the night before Christmas, 40 below, when Snoopy went up in search of his foe. He spied the Red Baron, fiercely they fought. With ice on his wings, Snoopy knew he was caught. Christmas bells, those Christmas bells, rang up from the land, asking peace of all the world and goodwill to man. The Baron had Snoopy dead in his sights. He reached for the trigger to pull it up tight. Why he didn't shoot, well, we'll never know. Or was it the bells from the village below? Christmas bells, those Christmas bells, ringing through the land, bringing peace to all the world and goodwill to man. The Baron made Snoopy fly to the Rhine and force forced him to land behind the enemy lines. Snoopy was certain that this was the end when the Baron cried out, "Merry Christmas, my friend!" The Baron then offered a holiday toast, and Snoopy, our hero, saluted his host. And then with a roar, they were both on their way, each knowing they'd meet on some other day. Christmas bells, those Christmas bells,
comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing the Whitewater Saga, and this is a story of Michael Peterson, who took the name of Ragnar. Now, the Whitewater was a prison kindred that developed in MCI Milan, Michigan, and the kindred was fostered by the relationship of Ragnar and Cedric, and also by the Life Connections program, which allowed prisoners to live near other prisoners that shared similar interests. Now, one of the first challenges that the kindred faced very early on in its development was that Ragnar was put into solitary. At this point, the group really had to focus on its spiritual mission in order to really stay consolidated. And so at this point, they began cooperating with the Woodpile kindred, which was another prison kindred. And they also got involved with something called the Saga Newsletter, which was published through the National Prison Kindred. Ragnar, at around this time, gets out of solitary, and he really tries to build up the kindred into a positive experience. But there's this one member who is very jealous of Ragnar and really wants to sow discord. Now, eventually, this individual gets demoted from hammer holder to seeker. As you might expect, this disgruntled member becomes even more disgruntled after being demoted. Now, eventually, this member becomes so problematic that he is given full outlawry, which is a type of banishment that you find in the Icelandic sagas. So after this, life really improves for the kindred, and it starts to become much more ambitious. And they start a political group called the APK. Now, this group had its own board, its own newsletters. This organization, as it turned out, as well you might imagine, took a lot of time away from the religious aspect. Well, I do believe that there is, or there ought to be, a strong political aspect to Ozitro. I also know that when one is consumed with politics, it is hard to find time for anything else. And as you might expect, this aspect of the kindred was eventually taken on by a National Socialist prisoner. And at around this time, Cedric gets transferred to MCI Pekin, and Ragnar looks for a way to brave this loss, and he turns to a more academic approach, really becoming a teacher of Azatro, even in terms of things like lore and probably theology. And some members of the kindred really reject this format because it is demanding. And so eventually, there are some kindred members that again become very disgruntled And Ragnar sends out a couple of infiltrators into their midst to see if they have any plots. Ragnar ends up disrupting a plot to steal a hammer, to steal one of the hammer pendants. He finds this someone that was associated with the Kindred and is kind of a hanger-on who ends up admitting to stealing the hammer. At this point, Ragnar decides to breed out weaknesses within the Kindred, but also around this time, Ragnar once again gets solitary. And at this point, he's transferred to FCI Greenville, at which point he goes into the Wotan's Wolf Kindred. So that ends the story of Whitewater, but this book also goes into the various bylaws of Whitewater. And this is really a helpful list for anyone wanting to start their own kindred. And it also contains the bios of various kindred members and how they ended up where they were at that time being in prison and how they hope that Odinism will help them to refocus their lives. Also at the beginning of the book, because it's written in a rather circular format, it also tells a bit about the shifting alliances with regard to the prison kindreds and really the struggles between a more universalist Ozotro, a more Wicca type of outlook, and also a more 14 words outlook, and how various groups have tried to take control of prison kindreds. And as you might expect, prison guards tend to favor a more left-wing interpretation of Ozotro, whereas the prisoners tend to be more oriented towards the 14 words. Today, the work of the Whitewater Kindred continues through the Gallows Tree Wotansvolk Alliance. This is an inspiring book, especially since it's literally written as a modern-day saga in the same narrative style as the old sagas. Now, today this group has a couple of YouTube videos and shows that in some form or other, this is an active group and they seem very family-oriented and they're really focused on moving past their troubles and onto a new focus in their lives. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and this is a book that, like many books, it's available on Amazon, and it's not a terribly long book. It's a very reasonable length. Really, it's something that I think you should take the time to read. So I hope you enjoyed this little summary and review. I think it's particularly appropriate during this Yule season. So thank you very much for listening, comrades, and have a good evening and hail victory.
On Christmas Eve, 1914, temperatures drop below freezing on the Western Front. In some places, it began snowing, obscuring the moon. Then all across the German lines, lights began to appear. At first, the British thought the Germans were preparing to attack. But instead of rifle fire, sounds of singing drifted across no man's land.
The Germans would be heard singing, "Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht." And the British would respond with a British Christmas carol. In some places, food was lobbed over into the opposing trenches. In one or two instances, the Germans erected Christmas trees. And There was a kind of mutual curiosity, and certainly instances of soldiers applauding each other's singing.
The curiosity led to something never again repeated on the battlefield.
In one or two places on Christmas Day itself, the first curious, slightly headstrong people, perhaps from both sides, poked their head above the trenches, and being made aware that somebody over the other side wasn't going to shoot it off, then clambered cautiously out.
One of the first to take part was Captain Charles Stockwell.
I ran out into the trench and found that the Saxons were shouting, "Don't shoot. We don't want to fight today. We will send you some beer." A German officer appeared and walked out into the middle of no man's land. So I moved out to meet him amidst the cheers of both sides. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other and seemed a very decent fellow.
By now, these soldiers knew that the war was going to last a long time and that many of them would not survive. The unofficial truce was a chance to bury the dead. At one funeral in No Man's Land, soldiers from both sides gathered to honor the fallen by reading the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
The Christmas truce was the last twitch of the 19th century. By that I mean it was the last public moment in which it was assumed that people were nice. It was the last gesture that human beings are getting better the longer the human race goes on.
December the 26th. At 8:30, I fired 3 shots in the air and put up a flag with Merry Christmas on it. The Germans put up a sheet with thank you on it. And the German captain appeared on the parapet. We both bowed and saluted. He fired 2 shots in the air. And the war was on again.
Hi guys. Well, guess what? You're going to hear those famous words out of my lips again. Something has come up. Something that demands my immediate time and attention. Something which only I can deal with, so only I will do. And so I'm going to have to slap something again in this last episode of 2015. This is the story of this year, people. I apologize like hell, but it is what it is. And once again, in this case, it just doesn't seem to be anything I can do except yield to the logic of the situation. Anyway, I'm going to pull part of the old fact podcast from 2010. It vaguely seems to me in my mind that I may have put this up before a few months ago. If so, I apologize for my senile memory, but it's worth hearing again. Spaced repetition. I'll see if I can get back and do a proper Christmas Eve wind-up for you. Next question, which I get in all kinds of contexts. Dear HAC, why not extend the Northwest Republic to Northern California, or Alaska, or Utah, or South Dakota, or Minnesota, or basically why not extend the Northwest American Republic to everything west of the Mississippi so I don't have to move? As you can guess, this idea comes mostly from people who live in San Francisco or Salt Lake City or Alaska or wherever, and it's basically a matter of they don't want to go to all the hassle and inconvenience of packing a moving van. We've been getting this ever since the publication of the first Northwest novels. People from Northern California, Alaska, Utah, Colorado, North and South Dakota, all over the show, often come to me suggesting that we include their home states in the projected boundaries of the NAR so that they don't have to move. I've seriously had people try to persuade me to include San Francisco and San Jose and Silicon Valley as part of the Northwest homeland so that people living there don't have to move. You look on a map, and despite the climate, you'll see just how far south along the California coast San Francisco is. As much as I would love to go into that beautiful city with the NVA and the SS and clean out all those filthy faggots and Oakland niggers from top to bottom, to call it part of the Pacific Northwest is absurd. Now, don't get me wrong, I get why these people want me to do this. Packing everything you own and moving stakes is an incredible hassle. Believe me, I get it, I do. God knows I should. I've done it myself often enough. As recently as 1998, at the age of 45, I was forced to reduce my entire life to a single suitcase. So I, of all people, know about the stress and aggravation of moving. I have nothing at all against these people who are trying to schmooze me into relieving them of the moral responsibility to pack that moving van, and I don't blame them for trying, not at all. I just can't let them do it. Now remember the whole theory behind what we're trying to do here, which is to concentrate our numbers in a given area to where we can actually form communities, real people living in the real world within half an hour's drive of one another, and begin functioning in the real world as opposed to the internet, and also to reduce the whole problem of white racial survival and revolution to manageable proportions. Remember, when the excrement impacts on the revolving blades, we want to be fighting a colonial war. Struggling for the independence of a far-flung outpost of empire, far removed from the capital and the centers of wealth and power, a backwater that the wealthy Jews and multinational corporate executives of Washington, D.C. and New York and Houston really won't be all that upset about giving up if it has to be done to preserve their power and their profits. We need land to grow into as a nation, true, but on the other hand, we have to keep this practical and we mustn't get too greedy. There are enough existing racially conscious whites so that if, I say if, we can ever get our act together, lay aside all our petty differences, stop listening to the goat-dancing idiots from the 1990s who hang around V-bulletin boards and still claim to lead us, and finally unite behind the Northwest migration as every ounce of remaining common sense dictates that we should. Now, if we can ever do those things, then we can easily concentrate 10 or 20,000 of us at least in 3.5 states. Now that will give us the basis for serious missionary work among the locals so that we can finally begin to draw our personnel not from this damaged and dysfunctional we movement of ours, but directly from the white community. Now that is a major strategic goal. We have to break out of the movement bubble. We have to start drawing our people directly from the population. Now, we could be doing that now, of course, except that nobody in the white population of the Northwest knows that we are here. Our websites are stuck on a few hundred hits per day, and we haven't yet figured out how to get any responsible establishment publicity without somebody getting killed and without standing on a street corner holding a sign and wearing a costume and making fools out of ourselves. If that ever changes, we'll be on our way. But we do still have to reduce the problem to manageable proportions. Now, the original proposed white homeland consisted of a core territory of three complete Northwest American states, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. In my novels, I referred to Wyoming, but that was fiction. We've since added Western Montana largely because of the intensity and dedication of one single female comrade who is forming her own primary settlement area in Kalispell. But at some point, guys, we've got to draw the line. At various times in the past, other parts of the Northwest have been suggested as potentially forming part of the homeland. Now, these include the northern third of California above Redding, the state of Wyoming, the state of Alaska, and the present Canadian provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. Now, those Canadian provinces I would especially like to include in the Northwest Republic when the time comes, but they'll be the responsibility of Northwest Front Canada. There is a half-assed independence movement in Alaska, but it's kosher conservative and capitalist and Sarah Palin-like in nature, and so it's useless as a vehicle for racial survival. There's also a separatist movement with a distinctly racial tinge to it that already exists in Western Canada, but they don't seem to have gotten very far with it. Neither have the French in Quebec, as far as that goes. The fact is that no separatist movement that attempts to use liberal democracy will ever get very far. Remember, the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. Now, for the entire 3.5-state settlement area, we're looking at a total of almost 300,000 square miles. Now, that's a lot of territory to cover, as I can tell you just from one road trip we did to Idaho a few months ago. We talk about reducing the scale of the problem, but let me tell you, the Northwest homeland is a big-ass place, and it's going to be hard for us to move around in it, given our limited resources, when even a single tank of gas is a major financial project. Imagine how it would be if we started to include these other areas and had to take road trips to Salt Lake City and Cheyenne or San Francisco, just because some of our people don't want to exert the necessary effort of will to pack the moving van. The whole purpose of reducing our operational area to something manageable would be defeated, just as we need communities of racially conscious white people living within half an hour's drive of one another. We need every place in the homeland to be within at least a long day's drive, max. Now, when the balloon goes up, I personally would like to glom on to as much territory as possible. If we're in some kind of situation whereby we can acquire Northern California and Utah and Wyoming or whatever, great. But we don't know exactly how and when and under what circumstances the inevitable breakup of the United States is going to occur. Until we have a little more information in that area, the Northwest Front has to keep to the present 3.5 states. Now, God knows they're going to be hard enough to work with. Next question. This is one that doesn't come from our own people. It's something that apparently is driving our hippy-dippy idiot enemies on the internet around the twist. And apparently they're really pestering Colonel House about this, so I'll give this a brief mention. That is all the heckles that we get on the blogs and our YouTube sites and just in general from Indians and Mexicans and mestizos of various kinds. We also get a lot of this drivel from white morons who think they're part Indian or who think there's something cool about Indians or who just basically have shit for brains. Anyway, their rap is as follows. White people don't belong here because Columbus was an imperialist exploiter and white people were mean and cruel to the Indians and anyway, the Indians were here first. Booga, booga, booga. Well, that assertion is so just plain wrong on every count, I don't even really know where to begin. First off, Columbus was not the first dead European white male to discover America. The Norse discovered America around the 10th century AD. They had some settlements up in Newfoundland and thereabouts, and if you believe the Kensington Runestone, they were actually still mounting expeditions to North America as late as 1361. Secondly, the Indians themselves were no prizes. They most assuredly were not noble savages. The Aztecs were the most technically advanced Indians at the time of the white arrival, but they liked to raid their neighboring tribes in order to capture people and then cut their hearts out with obsidian knives at the top of a pyramid as a sacrifice to the sun god. And it's known that the hearts and at least some of the other body parts of the sacrifices were then thrown to the mob and eaten as delicacies. Everyone has marveled that Hernan Cortes was able to conquer Mexico City and overthrow the Aztec Empire with only 700 men and 17 horses, but he had thousands of Indian allies who supplied him and helped him because they were so desperate to get the so-called noble and civilized Aztecs off their backs. You ever want a good movie version of that? Try Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. It deconstructs the whole noble Aztecs idea pretty thoroughly. Okay, I have a certain amount of time for the plains tribes like the Lakota and the Cheyenne and the Comanches, but the East Coast tribes the early settlers found were pretty scummy and really primitive. They were Stone Age savages who lived like animals and who routinely practiced torture and murder of any captives and the rape of any woman who fell into their hands. They had no written language, no ability to build in stone like even some of the Central American Indians had, and after thousands of years, they hadn't learned even rudimentary metalworking or agriculture or the domestication of animals. Thousands of years ago, American Indians and white people in Europe were on the same primitive level. White people advanced and learned and created and grew in mind and culture and technology. Indians never did, and they were still in the Stone Age when the first white settlers landed. Ah, but the idiots say the Indians were here first. Yeah, that's the official version, sure, and it has been for a century, but in the past few decades, some pretty interesting archaeological evidence has emerged that indicates otherwise. Now, I don't have the time here to go off into a long college degree course lecture, but I'll try to hit the high points for you. The discussion is hampered by archaeological and historical uncertainty on exact dates, since we're dealing with many millennia back and we can't know for absolute certain sure what happened that far back in time. And if I get into the question of how many thousands of years this and so-and-so BC that, I will be here all night. But basically, the evidence that Caucasians from Europe arrived in North America before the Asian ancestors of the Red Indians falls into two categories. First off, there's the scattering all over North America of stone artifacts, mostly spearheads and arrowheads, but also tools such as hand axes, and also artifacts made of bone such as fish hooks and needles, which indicate a connection with Europe, and which are found nowhere else but in Europe and parts of the American East Coast. Not in Africa, not in Asia, not in Polynesia, nowhere else. The most common of such artifacts are what's known as Clovis points, which are of a unique shape and manufacture, which I won't try to describe verbally, just take my word for it. They're very distinctive and identifiable, and you can easily find pictures of Clovis point stonework online. There is also a style of arrow and spearheads called Solutrean that looks sort of like a sharpened oblong or leaf shape, the oldest of which were found in caves and buried in Paleolithic strata around a town called Solutre in the Loire district of France. Now, these are about 15,000 years old, and they're believed by some scholars to be of Cro-Magnon origin. Now, from this we get the term Solutreans for our earliest white ancestors. Now, these Solutrean artifacts are also scattered all over North America, large numbers of specimens having been found in Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida. Nothing of the kind has ever been found in Asia or Siberia or in Polynesia, where the American Indians' ancestors are believed to have come from. Only in Europe. The second body of evidence, which indicates that white people came here first, is more fascinating and more conclusive, although more rare, and that is actual human remains. Now, the most well-known instance of this kind of evidence is Kennewick Man, whose skeletal remains were discovered in 1996 in Kennewick, Washington, right here in the homeland. Again, if I were to try and get into all the hanahana between scientists and the organized Indian lobby and the political left over the Kennewick remains, I'd be here all night. But to give you the Cliff Notes version, early examination of the remains caused forensic anthropologists at the University of California in Riverside to state their opinion that the remains were Caucasian. I should emphasize that determining the race of a human skeleton is one of the easiest things for a trained anthropologist or pathologist to do. It's Forensic Pathology 101. Skin color is by no means the only difference between the races. It's just the most obvious. Our whole bodies are built differently according to race, especially bone and skull structure. Often it's actually easier to tell the race of a deceased person than it is the gender, especially if you have an incomplete skeleton. Now remember, the first examination took place before all the sound and fury started, and so the experts routinely classified the remains as Caucasian. They figured Kennewick Man was a settler from the 19th century. But then the political problems started to appear. The radiocarbon dating showed that the remains were 9,300 years old, which is way, way before Columbus and Leif Erikson, way before any of us white boys are supposed to be around here in America, and what's worst of all, before the oldest known Indian remains. If the analysis was correct, then it means that the first people in North America were white. But since that conclusion was politically unacceptable, then the analysis and the scientists who made it had to be personally attacked and discredited. And oh boy, did the shit hit the fan then. The Kennewick remains were seized by court order and still remain the legal property of the Army Corps of Engineers, who refuses to allow access to them to any genuinely independent scientist. There was a legal battle for almost 10 years as the organized Indian tribes and their left-wing allies tried to prevent any further examination. The Army finally allowed brief access in 2005, but by then numerous Indians had been allowed contact with the remains, using various excuses, and the material was hopelessly contaminated. Parts of the skeleton were missing, and the whole thing had become so hopelessly politicized that no further examination can really be trusted. Contrary to popular belief, the actual results of a DNA test performed in 2005 were never released for anyone in the scientific world to examine for themselves. And again, contrary to the media, the original identification of the Kennewick remains as Caucasian has never been disproven. Of course, in the present political climate, for any reputable scientist to admit that the remains are Caucasian would be the end of his career. But there have been other ancient Caucasian human remains found in North America, including one at Lake Jackson, Texas, which was carbon dated at over 11,000 years old, and a woman's skull found near Mexico City, of all places, dated nearly 13,000 years ago. Both of these discoveries took place in 2002. And then there's the Spirit Cave mummy found in Nevada in 1940 that lay around the Nevada State Museum until 1996, when somebody finally got curious enough to have the remains carbon dated and found that the body was 9,400 years old, more or less contemporary with Kennewick Man, give or take a century. The mummy is said to, quote-unquote, exhibit Caucasian racial characteristics. Now, there is a lot of interest in this whole Salutrian thing in the movement, and there's a new novel coming out in October by a young man named Kyle Bristow called White Apocalypse, which deals with this whole issue of ancient white remains and the persecution of scientists who study them. I recently had the pleasure of reading and reviewing an advance copy in PDF format. Look, this is a fascinating subject, and if I don't shut up now, I won't shut up for an hour. I would, however, like to recommend that anyone who has truly got the Salutrian bug to go online to Amazon.com or wherever and order a DVD of a Discovery Channel program called Ice Age Columbus, Who Were the First Americans? It's well worth a viewing. It'll convince anyone with an open mind that, like everything else political correctness tells us, this business about the Indians being here first ain't necessarily so.
Magel magra es mujaltu muenta suris mevniastu mama knallen kutaktu kan fui mi fena vida gel magel ansula shelas bla Magel an krithal intlegra Geris lana togunke Islian murvata urtafas Alleluia God the Son, eternal one. You are my God and helpless son, high ruler of mankind.
Okay, I'm going to have to wind it up now because in addition to the other mess I told you about that just came up, we are now getting flickering lights here, which more often than not in this neck of the woods means an impending power outage, and we don't know how long that will last, so I need to get uploaded now, this afternoon. Look, 2015, on balance, was a rough year. Not catastrophic. There was a lot of positive stuff that happened during the year. Most notably, I think, my partial edition of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, which is now as close to a definitive English translation as exists anywhere in the world. And also, there was, of course, the translation of my own novel, The Brigade, into Russian, and the most successful fall building campaign the Northwest Front has had in a long time. But it was a rough year nonetheless. I expect that 2016 is going to be rougher still, not just internally, but due to an election which I think is going to be capable of reaching an 1860 level of significance for the country. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing Donald Trump and the Hildebeest go head-to-head in the general election. God, that's going to be more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Hopefully that will happen, despite all of the efforts of the GOP elders and the country club set to prevent it. But, for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anuban. Freedom. Now, I think I'll close with a number that, more than any other song I know, conveys the true spirit of the American Christmas experience. One that I know we all remember from our childhood Christmases. It's the very soul of the nation, raised in a paean of praise at the birth of the Savior of all mankind.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, as for me and Grandpa, we believe. She'd been drinking too much eggnog, and we begged her not to go. But she forgot her medication, and she staggered out the door into the snow. When we found her Christmas morning at the scene of the attack, she had hoof prints on her forehead and incriminating claws marks on her back. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now we're all so proud of Grandpa, he's been taking this so well. See him in there watching football, drinking beer and playing cards with Cousin Mel.
It's not Christmas without Grandma. All the family's dressed in black, and we just can't help but wonder, should we open up her gifts or send them back?
Send them back!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandma, we believe. Now the goose is on the table, and the pudding made of fig. Ah, and the blue and silver candles that would just have matched the hair in Grandma's wig. I've warned all my friends and neighbors, better watch out for yourselves. They should never give a license to a man who drives a sleigh and plays with elves. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. Now you can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandma, we believe.
Sing it, Grandpa.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandma,